On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we are covering the Padres ownership news, a very interesting and concerning lawsuit involving the Seidler family and who will be the control person of the San Diego Padres moving forward. We'll talk about Justin Verlander signing with the San Francisco Giants. Brent Rooker gets an extension. Gavin Lux gets traded. Got some funny tweets to talk about. And of course, we got the good, the bad, and the ugly. That and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that loves orange more than Justin Verlander. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and JV doesn't need to buy a new undershirt and hasn't had to in 20 years.
We are, of course, going to talk about Justin Verlander, the San Francisco Giant. It will not be our first topic, but we will get to it later. And yes, as you mentioned, the guy seems to like the color orange. I don't know if we need to really interrogate that. I don't know if that'll be one of the first questions at his introductory press conference. I'm sure Buster Posey will take that very
Nothing
seriously.
Rhymes with Verlander. Also on this show, we will talk about the incredibly messy Padres ownership drama. We'll dig into what's happened so far, what it means going forward, cover Brent Rooker's extension with the not in Oakland A's, Gavin Lux traded away from the Dodgers to the Reds, do a little sorry for your mentions, read an email, and do a good, bad, and ugly because it's the last show of the week. Pretty stacked episode of Baseball Barbacast. But before we begin, we're going to talk about a bunch of rich people yelling at each other in a second, which I'm sure if you live in the LA area, feels incredibly trivial right now with all the fires that are going on. So just wanted to say our thoughts are with all those folks. Very scary times out there. Hopefully us, you know, blabbering about the sport can provide a momentary distraction. But if you are in any evacuation areas, please find safety. Stay safe out there. I mean, I'm halfway across the world and it's news over here. So
yeah, no, it is a terrifying thing to watch from wherever you are. And I can only imagine what it's like for the people who are living nearby. So I definitely wanted to acknowledge that, as that is certainly on our minds. But let's get to it, Jake. We have a lot to talk about on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. And let us begin with the opener.
So this news dropped a couple days ago. And as our listeners know, I'm currently still on my honeymoon. I'm on a beautiful Thai island. And when you're on a beach vacation, you want harmless drama, right? To read about while you're sitting by the ocean, appreciating the crystal clear waters. It's something called a beach read. Now, I don't know if anybody else at this resort was reading the entirety of the complaint from Sheil Seidler to Matt and Bob Seidler, the brothers of the former owner of the San Diego Padres. But God dang it, Jordan, I was, because I was hooked. It is messy. It is ugly. It is certainly less than ideal, but it is a big story, and we're going to open with it on this episode.
Yeah, this is a massive deal. For those of you who have not been following the story since the beginning of the week, we're going to try and simplify it. I don't know if we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the legal complaint involving Sheil Seidler, the wife of the late Peter Seidler, owner of the San Diego Padres, who of course passed away in November of 2023. But this situation, as it boils down to, is basically who should be in charge of the San Diego Padres. And what Sheil Seidler is presenting in a legal form is the notion that with the recent news a little bit before the new year that John Seidler, the eldest brother of the late Peter Seidler, by the way, Peter Seidler had, I believe, 9 siblings.
And all of their names, or at least the people listed in the complaint, all one syllable.
Yes. So there's some confusion. And I don't know how many more there are that are involved in this, but our understanding is there are 3 primary characters as it stands right now, which is John, the eldest, who, again, they announced in December was going to be appointed the control person of the Padres, and Bob and Matt, who are now much more publicly involved in this back and forth with Sheil Seidler. And this is something that is hardly unprecedented in terms of an owner of a sports team passing away and a messy legal battle over who should control the team. That is not necessarily new. However, there are some dynamics involved here that certainly make this, I would say, unique.
Hop into the context. Peter Seidler, who was the control person and 45% owner, I believe he owned a plurality, but not the majority of the Padres. He became the control person of the club in 2020. And from 2020 until his passing in 2023, there is an argument he puts together one of the more celebrated tenures in baseball ownership history. He helps take the San Diego Padres from the most irrelevant franchise in the sport to a must-see TV item within the city. Petco Park becomes a center of the place. They change the uniform colors. They spend a lot of money, and they become important. They become relevant. They become pertinent. And I think that is Peter Seidler's legacy, is him transforming the Padres into what they are right now. Okay. So he spends a lot of money.
Yes.
He had been sick various times throughout his life. He had had cancer twice. He passes away last fall, I believe in November, at the age of 63. He leaves behind his wife, Sheil, and three young children. I believe the oldest at the time was 11 years old. As we mentioned, he has a baseball team of siblings as well. Those siblings had not been a public part of the San Diego Padres before his passing. Upon his passing, the control of the club then was temporarily in the hands of somebody named Eric Kutsenda. And that gentleman had been working with Peter Seidler in private equity for quite a long while, but that was always planned to be an interim thing. And since the passing of Peter Seidler over the last year, it seems that behind the scenes, bubbling, boiling, has been discord about who should be controlling the team. Put simply, this is the TLDR, Sheil Seidler, the widow, believes she should be the control person of the San Diego Padres. Bob Seidler and Matt Seidler, two of the brothers, believe that the Seidler brothership, essentially, should be in control of the San Diego Padres. That is the essence of this issue.
And there are a lot of allegations from both sides. I don't really want to get into the specifics of the treatment of both sides, which there's some very troubling and upsetting allegations involved of how Sheil Seidler has been treated.
Seems like some...
I don't want to...
It seems like some schism and some schism.
Yeah. There's obviously some very upsetting things in there involving racist comments and things directed towards Sheil Seidler, who's of Indian descent, that is obviously horrible. So I'm not trying to gloss over that as if it's not important, but logistically and functionally, the key here is there are a lot... What is really in dispute is the who understood was going to be taking over after the fact, and with both sides alleging that Peter had made it clear that it would go to Sheil, or had made it clear that it would not go to Sheil and that it would stay in the Seidler family. And so this is where the legal process is going to play out over some amount of time that is very important, and we are going to get to the timeline here in a little bit. But that is the conflict, which is very...
I'd like to call a time out here and say, if you're listening to this and you are outrageously wealthy and you own, say, a sports team, make it really clear who you want to run the team after you're gone, because having any level of ambiguity is just so not worth it. And avoidable. I'm going to say it right now, okay? In the event of my passing, 50% of Cespedes Family Barbecue LLC will pass on to my wife. Jordan, you will retain the other 50%, okay? You good?
Thank you. This is good. This is a good legal arena to make sure this is on there. But producer Andrew Hartz, do not edit this out.
This is a
out,
binding
okay?
document.
Make sure that this makes the final cut. Here's the thing. What I find most interesting about this situation is you bring up the concept of legacy. And a lot of times in these legal battles involving very wealthy people and very very valuable property, it's pretty straightforward. People want control of the property because it's valuable property, and they would like that to be in their possession so that they can continue to benefit from it financially. That's very natural, and that happens in many versions, many arenas beyond sports, and that all makes sense. But what is so interesting here, because Peter Seidler played such a unique role as an owner in the way that he acted, in the way that he embraced the community, in the way that he put his money where his mouth is in terms of saying, all I want to do is bring a World Series to this place that has never seen one, and that Shiel Seidler has been front and center, you know, by his side throughout, especially this last half decade. I mean, they've been married for much longer. But that element, and which is when Shiel Seidler puts out a statement and says that, like, this isn't just about that Shiel Seidler wants to keep owning the Padres so that she can keep making a bunch of money. It's that she wants the opportunity to continue, she, her words, right, to carry out Peter's vision. And when you get into kind of the PR part of this, and also just like the public reaction to this, the reality is people know Peter Seidler, and because they know Peter Seidler, Padres fans, they know Shiel Seidler. Nobody knows Matt and Bob Seidler because they haven't been a part of any of this. Yes, clearly they are his brothers, and you have to imagine they had some sort, they were paying attention to the Padres to some degree, but it wasn't the same thing. And so it's in the court of public opinion, which is not the most important thing here, as we'll get to, but it is relevant in the way that it is talked about. You can imagine that the average Padres fan is like, yeah, obviously, I want the person that was closest to Peter, that was at the ballpark all the time, that had relationships with members of the organization, whether it was players, whether it was front office, all these things. Why do I want these random people that have his same last name, but I've never seen before? Why do I trust them to carry out Peter's vision? There's no reason that you would believe that, right? There's why? Well, why would you? Now, again, it's not up to these people, and this is going to be a legal process that is going to require evidence from all sides, and that's where it's going to get even messier. But that's the thing. I mean, there's a vision here that Shiel clearly is very passionate about, and this is why it's a huge deal, because if you simplify it to the part of why we are talking about this on a baseball podcast, the Padres have been so relevant because of Peter Seidler. He has thrust them into relevance. He has, no matter what happens, whether they're stuck in this position, they have assembled a team that is going to remain relevant. But just how long they can stay relevant and just how long they continue to compete because of some of the roster situations they've left them is going to depend on how this gets resolved, undeniably.
I want to briefly explain just a nugget of the nitty-gritty here, which is how we got to where we are now. So in the wording of the trust, right, that Peter Seidler left behind, the executor of the trust, he left that to his brothers, not to his wife. Now, in the wording of that, very clearly, it says something along the lines of the executor of the trust is supposed to look after the well-being and financial wherewithal of Shiel Seidler, and she has access to the marital trust. But the issue there is that document assumes that the brothers are working in her interests, and it has been alleged, based upon her complaint, that they have not been doing that. And that goes beyond, if you read the document, simply controlling the San Diego Padres. Shiel alleges that since Peter's passing, she and her children have not been allowed to be in the owner's box. Okay? Let's say everything else is not true. Even that alone is inexcusable. It would be inexcusable for any owner, for any owner's family after their passing within the immediacy. But for someone like Peter Seidler, who transformed this franchise, for his family not to have access to that is flabbergasting and, frankly, quite embarrassing. Okay. So what? Now what? What does this all mean? What does this all do for the San Diego Padres? Where do we go from here? Now, the important thing to understand is that John Seidler, who is fascinatingly not a defendant in the complaint, okay, John Seidler seems to be being used as a pawn, as a meat shield by his two younger brothers in this instance. He is the one who is being nominated as the control person to Major League Baseball. He has not been approved as that control person just yet. There is a vote in February where three quarters of MLB owners need to approve him in order for John to be the control person. And that explains the timing of this entire story.
Yeah, so we don't know for sure if that is going to happen in February, but there are owners' meetings in February, and that would be the first opportunity for him to get approved. But the fact that this is now all happening, could this delay it? Could this make it a situation where, you know, the owners decide like, whoa, hold on, like, we are not in position to vote on John right now because of this ongoing legal dispute? Or they'll say, we're going to force this through. And this is the part that is, I think, most crucial and also challenging to talk about, because I just don't really know, is John Seidler would require three quarters of MLB owners' approval. I don't know, as things stand now, where MLB owners would stand on this for a lot of reasons. I could presume some things based on previous actions and ways that owners have talked. I can't speak to all their owners' relationships, past relationships with Peter Seidler, present relationships with Shiel Seidler, present relationships with any of these other Seidlers, right? Maybe there were relationships there that we don't know about. I mean, the Seidler family, you know, Peter, grandsons of Walter O'Malley, like this is a family that has been in baseball for a long time. Grandson of Walter O'Malley, who was the Dodgers owner, you know, decades ago. It's not implausible that these other Seidlers could have some amount of relationship with these other owners, even if it's been super duper behind the scenes. But that is the part that I don't really know, but it is so important as to what happens next, is the likelihood that John Seidler was going to be approved before this, and if that has now changed because of this situation, and when that could happen. Because all of that will likely impact what in the world the Padres can actually do with their baseball team from now until opening day, let alone the deadline. And
you got to watch Succession, man. Like, you really got to watch it. If you are interested in this, now granted there's baseball involved in this, and I understand you seem to like that sport, just watch it. It's good. And it's like this. And I think
I'm not sure I'm enjoying this. I gotta say, I this is not okay. Like, I don't think I'm not using this is not a selling point. I've had many. This is not the first podcast where Jake has said, you gotta watch Succession, or the first conversation I've had with anybody that says, you gotta watch Succession.
It's
literally
good.
Happened to me last night, but I get it. I'm sure it's a good TV show, but all of this is not, this is not a fun topic. Like, it, yes, it is very wealthy people and there are more important things happening in the world, but it is interesting for sure. It is compelling. And if I'm going to super duper narrow it to like the Padres baseball team, which I am certainly interested in my little bubble, like, yeah, that's
so
relevant.
You bring that up.
There's a lot of directions this could go.
We were talking earlier about teams that have done nothing this winter, right? And the Padres were suspiciously one of those teams, which is bizarre considering how active they tend to be. AJ Preller loves himself a transaction as the general manager of the club. And this explains the inactivity, right? They are in something of a financial holding pattern where they can't operate and conduct any significant moves until they rectify this in some form or fashion, right? They certainly can't add payroll. Now, could they trade away Luis Arraez to cut payroll from their books? Sure, they could do that. But this just goes to explain, in my mind, why they've been so silent. Now, the last point I want to make here is if you go into the comments of any of the stories, whether it's on The Athletic or on Twitter or wherever, right? You read the comments. What do they all say? Roky Sasaki. It's all Roky Sasaki. Now, this is bigger than Roky Sasaki, obviously. There are billions of dollars at stake here. But the Japanese phenom who has to make a decision about where he's going to play within the next 2 weeks, the Padres have been rumored to be one of the front runners for him. Okay? And I do think this story is relevant in terms of the Roky Sasaki situation. Roki, for all we know, okay, we have no idea what he wants, what he prefers, what he's interested in. This can't help. This level of disorganization and discord and confusion and mess is not an appealing attraction to someone who wants to develop into a better player in an environment where they feel cared for and where they feel fostered, right? And so while I do think it is overly simplistic to just slam the Roki button here, I do think that the impact here is non-zero.
And there's a Sasaki mention in the lawsuit. Now, it's citing a San Diego Union Tribune article, but it's talking about the recruitment of players like him. Remember, we talked about this on this show. At the celebration of life where AJ Preller spoke after Peter Seidler's passing, he name-dropped Roki Sasaki as like a player that they are looking forward to pursuing. He said that publicly. Like, that was something that he had been talking about with Peter Seidler. So all of this unrest and complications is not just a matter of like, oh, wow, that's a mess. Do I want to get... It's just like, if you're Roki Sasaki, if you're any player, by the way, that wants to sign with the Padres, you would like to know the vision for the team. That's a very important thing. And that could be, well, will be determined by who is ultimately the control person. So I think that lays out the important parts. This is not going to go away, and we will continue to talk about this on the show as we get updates. But it's just a huge deal. I mean, again, the Padres have been one of the most important teams in Major League Baseball for the last few years. And how this goes will make a difference with that. They're still going to be relevant one way or the other, in part because of this. But, you know, it seemed like there was an era opening of like, this is it. Here we go. Golden era Padres baseball. Again, they were not far away from eliminating the Dodgers a few months ago. And it all came crashing down. And now they are in a very, very tenuous position. So we will see. I mean, if you are a lawyer and have any insight on this and want to email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, like, go ahead. But I'm looking forward to reading some legal perspectives on this. I can't believe I just said that, but it's true. Like, I am interested. But we'll see. And I guess while there's plenty we could get into, the most important thing to understand is that this is important. And I'm really curious where it goes from here.
All right. Enough legal talk. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about baseball specifically. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Justin Verlander has signed a one-year, $15 million deal with the San Francisco Giants. And it popped the question in my head. Has a grandfather ever thrown a pitch in Major League Baseball?
I don't think Justin Verlander is that close to grandfather status. Yes, relatively. He is. We mentioned at the top his affinity for Orange. Are you feeling a little left out? The Orioles are, I think, the last team left to check off here in his Orange quest, and they opted for Charlie Morton for 1 year and $15 million instead of Justin Verlander for 1 year and $15 million. The Detroit Tigers, also Orange, also used to employ Justin Verlander, gave Alex Cobb 1 year and $15 million to pitch for them. These three pitchers will now be a fascinating trio to compare if and when Max Scherzer signs for 1 year and $15 million. Boris is going to be like, no, 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 it's going to be $15 million.
And a cent.
$100,000. Yeah, and a cent. We can add him to the pile here. This makes a lot of sense. We talked a little bit earlier this week about Justin Verlander still being out there with Max Scherzer. I voiced my relative confidence in Verlander relative to Scherzer. I'm a little biased because I watched him at the end and I listened to him talk and I was like, damn, I'm sold. I think he's about to figure it out, but he's not going to make the postseason roster, so we're not going to see it. And I think that he will learn from this past season And while I can't guarantee you that he's going to stay healthy, obviously, but I think that he will make the adjustments necessary. And I think pitching in San Francisco is a good place for him to figure some stuff out. And they could use him. And I think at this point in the Giants offseason, we've been waiting for them to do literally anything since they signed Willy Adames. They do not seem like they are interested in signing any of the players that still have a qualifying offer attached, as we've kind of talked about this with the Yankees after signing Max Fried. Same thing with the Giants and Willy Adames. If they sign an Alonso, Pivetta, whatever, I mean, you're essentially punting on their draft. They'd be having, you know, four of their top five picks gone. And for a team that does not have a very good farm system, that's probably not something they want to do. But they still clearly had money to spend. And this is kind of a cool way to do that and adds an element to their rotation that they didn't really have. And does this make me think the Giants are now like threatening the Dodgers? No, but as far as fits for Justin Verlander go, like I like this one a lot.
Justin Verlander hasn't been on a bad team in a while. He was on the Mets for 25 minutes and then concocted his way out of there, saved himself. And part of that is why I like this move for Justin Verlander, because if the Giants are bad and he's competent, they will just trade his ass at the deadline and he will end up playing somewhere else. And if he's bad and the Giants are good, he just gets to live in the Oakland Hills with his bags of money and he'll be fine. And I do think that he did not need to hold out for the last dollar here. He maybe could have got a little bit more money from a different team, but finding a place where he knew he had a rotation spot where he could prove that he's capable of still pitching in the major leagues at a competitive level, that was important for him. Now, you talk about his ability to make adjustments. And I think that from a theoretical level, that's great. But you have to physically be able to make the adjustments, Jordan. Like, if you can't touch your toes, it doesn't matter how much you want to touch your toes. Now, I'm not saying that Justin Verlander is some sort of physical bum at this point. Like, he's still an elite athlete.
You did call him a grandpa. That was
that's
the
not
first
what I
thing
said.
You said about him.
It's not what I said. So. It just got me thinking about grandfatherhood, really.
Oh, okay. Well, it is relevant. I mean, I can't dispute that. And this is part of why I tweeted about this today. Like, the list of pitchers who have started any amount of games at age 42 or older, he's going to turn 42 right before the season, it's a short list. And it involves a lot of outliers. But guess what? That's what Justin Verlander is. He fits into that group of Randy Johnson and Roger Clemens and Maddux and Smoltz and Glavin. And by the way, a lot of those guys sucked. Smoltz, Glavin, terrible in their age 42. They were done. Maddux, right? It was over. Roger Clemens was probably benefiting from some things and was still amazing. Randy Johnson hung on for a while. Bartolo's in there. And then you have the lefties who just can soft toss their way into their mid-40s. Verlander's not going to have that luxury, right? You can't, when you're right-handed, it's a lot harder to throw 91. But
he starts throwing lefty.
Or he starts throwing lefty, which again, I don't think that's on the table yet, but that would be one way out of this. The other fun thing about this is just, it's a very strange aesthetic fit. The orange part we get. Justin Verlander has not pitched in San Francisco since game one of the 2012 World Series. He only pitched there one other time in 2008. He's never been in Arizona spring training. Like, seeing him in Phoenix is like, again, this is like maybe a niche baseball thing that nobody cares about, but I do think about it, and I know players care about it. But I think getting back to what you were saying before in terms of why he would take this, the Giants are the perfect medium of, like, to your point, they could trade him if they're not good. They're not bad enough to where it's like there's no way they're going to be relevant, you know, later on in the season, even if we don't think they're like a 95 win team. And like, if you're Justin Verlander and you need to make sure you know where you're going, like, that dude is not in a physical position to sign in March and be ready for opening day. Like, that he needs to get in with he needs to start already collaborating with the training staff and understanding, like, this is how I am going to train and stay healthy and pitch and make 25 starts. So that conversation needs to start sooner rather than later. And I have to imagine if you're Max Scherzer, you're probably also thinking the same thing, and we'll see if that ends up happening. But I think that for Verlander, I have to imagine that also helped him kind of sign.
Verlander has been very public about wanting to pitch until he is 45. And he has been very public about his desire to strive for 300 career wins. 300 wins used to be the threshold of elite upper echelon greatness. If you got to 300, you were in the Hall of Fame. Now, Verlander is going to be in the Hall of Fame anyway, and pitching and baseball has changed so dramatically over the last 20 years that 300 wins is no longer a realistic threshold for anybody at all, right? Because wins are goofy and no one pitches deep into games like they used to. That being said, Justin Verlander being the last, being the final 300 game winner is so badass. And if he gets that, I totally understand like wanting to strive towards that. That to me is a reasonable goal. Does he get 38 more wins?
That will require him to basically have another season like he did in 2023, where it's like, you're a good pitcher. And we keep on. And also you need just like a ton of luck. Like you need to, he would need to luck into 12 wins this year and then clearly be healthy.
San Francisco?
Because otherwise 38 more wins is
San Francisco, though. Good place to pitch. Anything else on Justin Verlander? Because yeah. I would like to move on to another team in the division.
No, I just think, again, the Giants rotation. I'm really curious if they actually let Jordan Hicks try and start again. It seems like they're going to, but I don't know. And I, if that's their whole offseason, that's also kind of wild. But just the Willie Adames, Justin Verlander combo is something. But maybe they have more moves left in them. All right, let's get to this trade. Trades are always more fun. Let's be real. So let's talk about Gavin Lux. Tell me about this trade.
Infielder Gavin Lux sent from the Los Angeles Dodgers to the Cincinnati Reds in exchange for a draft pick in the Comp A round, one of the draft picks you are allowed to trade, and Mike Sirota, an outfielder, minor leaguer prospect. Let's start with Lux, and then we can boot up Jordan's prospect hut. Gavin Lux, first round pick out of a Wisconsin high school, develops into one of the top prospects in baseball while in the minor leagues with the Dodgers. And I think that there is a lot of hype. And there's a conversation of, did Gavin Lux live up to the hype? And I think the answer to that is unequivocally no. Now, I am a Gavin Lux apologist, believer, and advocate. And I would say that his leg turning into spaghetti during spring training, where he tore his ACL and was robbed of an entire 2023 season, is an extremely significant part of his tenure in LA and sidetracked his development in a very notable way. He comes back in 2024 and is pretty bad for the first half of the season as he's kind of working his way back physically. Down the stretch with the Dodgers this year, like legitimately great offensively with LA. Now, he's not great in the postseason, even though he does drive in the go-ahead winning run in Game 5 on a sac fly. I find Lux to be a fascinating player. I think he has a lot of room left to be good, and he's still only 27 years old. Any argument about Lux, I will always side with him. I really like the guy. I think he can still be really good. Where do you fall on this?
Yeah, I will say, just to correct, it was the tying run in the eighth. And the reason I'm correcting you, just to bring it up again, I won't go into the specifics, but I will say, because you remember this, one of our highlights, I would say, from the post-game celebration being on the field was talking to Gavin, who we've known for a good while, about that at bat. And just like understanding the spot there, because at the time, this is Luke Weaver had come in, and it was bases loaded, nobody out. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, because remember, the Yankees had scored again after the catastrophic inning. The Yankees had retaken the lead, but we all assumed like, well, it doesn't matter. Like the Dodgers are obviously going to score again. And that sac fly against Weaver, full count, and talking to Lux about just like understanding the spot and understanding like you cannot strike out here. And to him realizing that and then getting that job done, he did a job, was awesome. And obviously knowing him and what he'd been through was really, really cool. I wrote about Lux earlier this week, and the point I made about the hype that I always thought was unfair is that 2019 breakout was kind of goofy. It was a big juiced ball situation what he did in AAA over those few months that led to his call up kind of created a caricature of the kind of player that he actually was. And so then you had this, when he goes into 2020 and he's just coming off this ridiculous slugging season, everyone's like, oh my God, he's one of the best prospects in baseball. When in reality, he was a very good prospect who had an all-time heater. And then the timing, you know, lifted him up to a point where he was still rookie eligible. And then as this super hyped guy, it takes him a while to really establish himself, but he does become a very important player on a championship team. And I think we can give him credit to that. Let's spin it to Cincinnati. What do the Reds need Gavin Lux for? I think that the notion of like, okay, well, first of all, the Dodgers were said, well, they had too many infielders, and we can get back to them in a second. The Reds, it's like, oh, they have too many infielders. Okay. The Reds need good baseball players, and Gavin Lux is a good baseball player. And they are not in a situation where it's like, there's no room for this guy. Like, no. Gavin Lux will make them better. They desperately needed more left-handed offensive competence, let alone like actually potentially very good, especially based on what he did in the second half. It is interesting, though, because the one player that I am fascinated about this upcoming season is Matt McClain, who was the Reds' best player in 2023 as a rookie, missed all of 24 because of labrum surgery, but now he's coming back and second base is his primary position. It seems like Lux is going to move around. Is that a good idea? Do I think he's a good candidate for third base? No. Do I think he's a reasonable candidate for a corner outfield? Honestly, probably. Like, I think that's fine. Is it a great plan A? No. Is it a creative solution if you're a team like the Reds and you clearly aren't going to spend a lot of money? I guess. And you have 2 years of him, and I think he should hit well in that park. It's a strange fit, and I think they did pay a decent price. But I like that they were like, all right, well, this is our opportunity to get a good baseball player for 2 years. And it'll be cool to see Lux playing in a much lower pressure environment. And he will definitely have less Japanese media to worry about.
That's for sure. Who's playing shortstop for the Dodgers? The Dodgers think it's Mookie Betts, and I think that's outrageous because we just did this last year.
Yeah.
And I am fascinated what their plan is. Now, maybe they just let Miguel Rojas play more regularly, and he's just more of a regular shortstop than we think. And the last takeaway I have here is you said on the last pod, it's hard to envision Kike Hernandez finding his way back onto this team. Well, Jordan, I agree with you, but it just got a little bit easier.
I guess. I think they're a lot more likely to go after a left-handed hitter. I mean, this is the other big takeaway, is that, okay, whatever I said about, or they said about Hi-Sung Kim being a super utility player, seems like he's going to be the second baseman. And so that is an interesting decision. It seems like if they are committed to Mookie at shortstop, that probably means Tommy Edmonds mostly playing center field. But sure, you're right. If Kim does end up hitting a lot less and they want him to be more in a bench role, then yes, you probably are having Mookie play second and Edmund play short or Rojas play short. And there's all kinds of options there. But in general, it feels like this does clarify if they are not lying about Mookie at shortstop, which I honestly don't think they are. We kind of know what this lineup looks like. And my God, is it a good lineup? And even if Hi-Sung Kim like plays decent defense and steals 30 bases and hits 150, it's the best lineup in baseball. So that's the Dodgers, and that is why they are who they are. Quickly on these prospects, before we get to Brent Rooker, I won't spend too much time on this, but come on in for just a brief little session in Jordan's Prospect Hut. Mike Sirota is an athletic outfielder.
Not Mike Soroka.
Not Mike Soroka. Both of them in the news this winter, but no, Mike Sirota. He was an outfielder, third round pick this past season out of Northeastern University. The Dodgers drafted him out of high school. He was an interesting kind of pop-up high schooler in Connecticut. He did not sign in 2021, goes to Northeastern. And going into his junior year, it was like, oh, this guy could be a first rounder. And then it was just a not great start, and he didn't hit for as much power. The underlying stuff still said he was very good, but when you're playing not the best competition and you only hit like 7 or 8 home runs in college baseball in 2024, which is about as power friendly as it gets, it's like, how good are you really, dude? But clearly the Dodgers still liked him. And now, again, they made a very similar trade a year ago with the Michael Busch trade, where they were like, listen, Michael Busch, you're probably good, but we don't need you right now. Same thing with Gavin Lux. It's not like they think Gavin Lux stinks. They're just like, another team could use him more. Let's get someone that will help us in the future. That's Mike Sirota. That's a draft pick, you know, that's going to be in the mid-30s. And I would not be surprised if Mike Sirota has a great season for the Great Lakes Loons, whose hat I'm wearing, and then they roll from there. So, yeah, but we'll see. But, you know, good for them. I think this is a good return, all things considered, for Lux, who clearly was on his way out. That would become very obvious.
One more topic before we take a break. The Athletics are spending money. Brent Rooker getting a 5-year extension from the Nomadic A's, who are moving to Sacramento this season for a brief 3-year spell before absconding to Las Vegas, allegedly. The deal is $60 million, can go up to $90 million with escalators. It's $30 million over the next 3 years. It essentially buys out 3 arbitration years, and then he gets 2 of those free agent years bought out. First of all, clap it up for Brent Rooker. Clap it up for Brent freaking Rooker. Because
we love this for him.
Dude, first of all, like, awesome guy. Just quickly, slugging percentage 2024 Major League Baseball rankings. Aaron Judge, 1. Shohei Ohtani, Bobby Witt Jr., Juan Soto, Yordan Alvarez, Brent freaking Rooker. Jordan Schusterman, please explain to people how Brent Rooker even ended up on the A's in the first place.
I mean, this is a hell of a development story. It's a very modern development story, right? I mean, this is someone who essentially realized in college when he was at Mississippi State, he was like, I am good, but I can be this much better. Like, he kind of figured out, like, I am very strong and I have this knack of elevating the ball in the air with force. And even if I'm going to strike out, I can be an extremely productive hitter if I make these slight swing adjustments and have, you know, the combination of plate discipline / swing mechanics / power / approach, right? And he had one of the greatest seasons in SEC history. But in pro ball, it takes a while. He bounces between a few different organizations because this player type is not the kind of player type that gets a lot of patience. They usually end up stuck in the upper minors. And that's what happened with him, with Minnesota, with San Diego, who sure could use him at DH right now, with Kansas City, who sure could use him right now. He ends up with the A's, and it just all comes together. And I say it's a modern story because, again, you pull up the Savant page and you pull, it's like, yeah, the dude's striking out a lot. And it doesn't matter, because if you can slug this much and you understand what pitches you can do damage on, you can be one of the most feared hitters in the league. All of that said, you just read those names and you say, oh my God, what a bargain for the A's to get this guy for $60 million over 5 years. And I don't think that's totally wrong. But this is a guy, because he was a late bloomer, he's a 30-year-old DH who would have been hitting free agency at like 34 as, again, likely a DH. Like,
this is
that's
fine.
Not the kind of guy that gets paid.
Look at, like, Pete right now. Look at Pete Alonso. Pete Alonso,
right.
Right-handed hitting slugger type. He did this for six.
He's been slugging like
six years. Okay. He was Brent Rooker for 6 years.
Right.
Like, I got a text from someone that was like, I can't believe he took this much less to stay with the A's. It's like, for a certain type of player, you take the money when the money's on the table. And this, to me, makes a lot of sense for Brent Rooker because, look, he could slip on a banana peel. This is not someone who has made a lot of money in his career. And so you got to take the opportunity when it's in front of you.
Brent's season this past year was, I mean, it wasn't, you know, Pete's rookie season in terms of bulk, but like OPS plus wise, it was better than anything we've seen from Alonso. But still, that player type is just, that might have been his best season. That's also possible, right? As much as I love Brent Rooker, that might have been his best season. And so when you have this opportunity, now, okay, so now let's zoom back out. Because now we're having a conversation, as we did when they gave Luis Severino a bunch of money. Which is, how am I supposed to feel about this? I'm happy for Brent Rooker. We talk about, okay, awesome. Like, Sacramento is going to be excited for Brent Rooker. Vegas now gets to know that Brent Rooker, by that point, is like age 34. Who knows how good he is at that point, is like the guy, right? This is the guy now. This is their guy. it's an interesting player type to build around. I hope he continues to be awesome for the next 5 years, but who knows? And it's like, great, I'm glad you're investing in this one guy, and I'm glad he's all for it. I'm glad he's the benefactor of it. But I don't know what I'm supposed to say about this. It still feels icky. It still sucks that now they're waking up and investing in their players.
And the reason they're doing this is because they have to. Now, when I say they have to, here's what we mean. It is in the collective bargaining agreement, the CBA, that a team receiving 100% of its revenue sharing must have a payroll that is 150% of that revenue sharing money, right? So MLB pays teams money that are on the lower end of revenue so that it evens out, so that the Yankees don't just poop on everybody every year, right? And the Dodgers. That's essentially what it is, okay? So that revenue number for the A's this year is reported to be somewhere, I believe, around 70-ish million. That's the amount they're going to get. And it's the first year under the new CBA where they're getting 100% of that total. What that means is they need to have a payroll that is 150% of that 70 million. And that number, depending on your calculations, is somewhere around like 120-ish, right? Now, that's why the A's are spending. They're spending the difference between where their payroll was and where it needs to be so that they can get that $70 million payment and avoid a grievance with the MLB Players Association. It is simply, at this point, good business to spend the money. Now, it is arguably always good business to spend the money, I would say. But they're doing it in this particular circumstance so that they can get that payment.
Yeah. And again, when you pull up their payroll on Roster Resource, like you can see if you add up the salaries together, that number is still close to like 65 million, at which point you say, oh my God, they still have a long way to go to get to 100 or a little over 100, whatever. The actual number that we're talking about is the luxury tax payroll. And that includes like additional player benefit money. And that's like almost $20 million. Like there's other money that is added to that number, and that's the CBT luxury tax. And that number right now is closer to $100 million. They still probably are going to need to spend a little bit more than where they're at based on the contract. I mean, and we just got the Rooker contract details, and it seems like a lot of the actual salaries are more backloaded, so he's not making as much this year, which means that number is not as high as we maybe would have been if he was making $10 million or so this year. They probably still have a few more moves in them, but to your point, that is part of why they are now investing
in it. It's not like this ownership group woke up and was feeling altruistic or is genuinely trying to get the city of Sacramento buzzing about this group. There's more at play here than those factors. All right, let's take a quick break.
Yes, but again,
like you said, great for Brent Rooker. For the people who are going to sit down and watch this team play baseball this year, people in Sacramento should care about this. They should get invested. We're feel good about people in Vegas. They should care about this team. We're not hating on those fans. We obviously feel bad for those in Oakland. When we get back, we got a roll of segments for you. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Every so often on the internet machine, someone rips off a tweet, a post, an X that has the mentions buzzing. And it's a little segment we like to call Sorry for Your Mentions. Now, this is a special edition of Sorry for Your Mentions. We are not going to read the main tweet and all the replies to it. We are just going to read one reply.
One mention. And normally when we do this, it's, you know, team posts, final score graphic, fans are very mad, and we feel bad for the people running the social account. In this case, this is a tweet originally from the MLB Network account sharing the Hall of Fame ballot of one John Morosi. But we are going to focus on one reply, one mention that came in particular from one Jazz Chisholm Jr., second baseman, third baseman for the New York Yankees.
Future Hall of Fame ballot member?
It's got a few more years, but maybe.
Jazz says.
What did Jazz say?
This might be one of the worst hands over eyes emoji. Now, Sorry, John Morosi, for your mentions. This is outstanding for a number of reasons. This is so freaking funny. One of the worst is great, right? Because there's an implication that Jazz is like scrolling through every single Hall of Fame ballot and being like, this one is not quite the worst.
That's true. We're going to have more Hall of Fame discussion next week. My one question about this is, we should just do quickly. John Morosi voted for Carlos Beltran, Mark Burley, Andrew Jones, Ian Kinsler, Brian McCann, Jimmy Rollins, CeCe Sabathia, Ichiro Suzuki, Chase Utley, Billy Wagner. And the reason I'm saying all those names is, what about this ballot do you think personally offends Jazz?
I don't think it's a mystery. I think it's pretty clearly Brian McCann.
Interesting. Really?
Yeah.
You think that's his number one? You think that's his
what
number
is one of the things that Brian McCann is most known for and remembered for?
You could be right. That's
blocking
true.
Celebrating player from crossing home plate.
Yeah. And Jazz, because of how old he is, right? Maybe that's all he knows about Brian McCann. I guess that's possible. That's interesting. I guess that could be the answer. I would be very curious, like, what else about this is horribly offensive? I should note that he's not the only person that's voted for Brian McCann.
Yes.
So that's, well, again, we'll do more Hall of Fame discussion next week, so we'd have to do that all right now. But that's an interesting theory. I maybe you're right. I don't know. I know I'm most offended because he didn't vote for Felix.
Well, yes.
But, you know, he's not
the most egregious votes on here. If you're going from like a who should be in the Hall of Fame perspective, it's probably Burley, McCann, and Jimmy Rollins. I don't think there's any way Jazz is pissed about Jimmy Rollins, in my opinion. And you also have to remember, when Jazz comes up into the league, some of these players, these are the guys who are like just departing. And so he had just watched these guys be old and bad. Like, he had just seen Ian Kinsler and the Red Sox be ass. And so in his mind, it's like, oh, why are you voting for these players who were so bad that they needed to like refresh the league? And I came up, you know what I mean? Like, I understand that mentality for him. That being said, Jazz, listen, brother. Not that bad of a ballot. It's not, in my opinion, what I would do. And we'll talk about our ballots next week. I would say this is actually like a 50th percentile quality ballot for me. This is like right down the middle.
And generally, I have a much bigger problem with voting for two people than 10 people.
Yeah.
So, but Jazz, come on Baseball Overcast. Let us know who you would vote for, because his tweet leaves a lot of ambiguity. But anyway, that's our edition of Sorry for Your Mentions. I don't really know who I'm sorry to there, but it was a mention that caught our attention. And
I'm sorry to one of the 10 people that John Morosi voted for, because Jazz doesn't like you.
We don't know who, but that's the thing. I'm curious if it's someone who he did vote for or someone who he didn't. I would love to know that from Jazz, but maybe we can find out.
Next up, let's break open the mailbag for an incredible, incredible story from one of our loyal listeners. This is from Daniel Carroll, and it has the subject line, Mookie Betts, the bowler. Let me read. Hi, guys. You'll have to forgive me for not going into great detail on this message, but I had an experience this weekend that you might enjoy hearing about and following up on, and my brain is fried at the moment. So I think the best thing might be for me to give you the basics. I was participating in a bowling tournament this weekend in Seattle, and as I was looking over scores at the event, I saw that I was indirectly competing with Mookie Betts. I did not get the chance to speak with Mookie, and I never shared a lane with him, but I was watching his scores roll in and comparing them with mine all weekend over the 12 games of the tournament. In total, I won 5, lost 6, and we tied once. My 12-game total ended 33 pins higher than Mookie's. Congratulations. You beat Mookie. Quote, Mookie Betts is at my bowling tournament is a sentence that I never thought I would be able to legitimately say. And to be perfectly honest, it feels like a children's book. Like, quote, my teacher is an alien. It was real weird seeing him there at my home bowling center. And I was more excited to see him than I was to see guys like PBA Tour Pros Marshall Kent, PJ Haggerty, Francois Lavoie, and PWBA champion Stephanie Zavala. Whoa. Yeah.
Damn. Some of the big name drops.
As a rec level men's league baseball player, I am occasionally asked if I'm a better bowler than Mookie Betts, and I don't think it would be reasonable for me to say yes. But with these results, I also don't think it would be reasonable for me to say no. I like to consider myself a dollar general Mookie Betts, and I can because I effectively play any position in rec baseball. Anyway, it was a weird time. It feels like the kind of thing you would all enjoy, Daniel. Incredible. Incredible story.
Great stuff. So first of all, I mean, for those who don't know that Mookie Betts is a bowler, loves bowling. This is a thing. I mean, not only is we know that he does this, he goes and competes in tournaments in the offseason. And apparently not just in Los Angeles. Like, he'll go wherever.
That's the thing. To me, that's the wild thing. He's either calling the private jet or like hopping on into first class for like a 4-hour flight. 3-hour flight to go to Seattle for the weekend.
It does tell me that this must be a pretty serious bowling.
I mean, if Francois Lavoie was
wherever
there,
this was,
and PJ Haggerty's coming through.
I know. That's true. My other thing that I love about this is that he doesn't like do it under an alias. Right now, obviously, some people would recognize Mookie Betts, but he doesn't have to put his name. Like, in theory, he could come up with the Madison Bumgarner, you know, Mason Saunders thing and probably deflect a lot of attention. Like, and instead, he just puts it in there. It's like Mookie Betts. And I love that because it provided Daniel with moments like this.
What is a task or a game you think you could beat major leaguers at pretty consistently?
Much longer conversation.
Because
that's a good question.
You know,
I mean, this is so cool though, right? Because clearly Daniel can bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, there was obviously, this was not a tournament that just anybody could enter, and Daniel he can spin them.
You know,
he can rack up some pins, you know, here.
Disheartening. It seems like they rolled on Shabbos.
Oh, is that true? Wow, that changes some things. Has Mookie been asked about Big Lebowski? I don't know. Anyway, this is an amazing email. Thank you, Daniel. Loyal listener. And wow, amazing. Very ugla, by the way. But now it is time for the good, the bad, and the ugla. Something good, something bad, something Dan ugla. Just a little bit strange that we want to talk about from the week of baseball. Jake, start us off with something good.
There is a video that went semi-viral this week of Shohei Ohtani throwing a baseball. That in and of itself is not surprising or really notable because he is a two-way player. Yeah. Who is going to be returning to the mound this season to pitch. But what was amazing about this particular video is where it is happening. It is at a high school in Pasadena. And in the background of the video, you can see a gaggle of children aged 9 or 10 scurrying into a net, a green net, to retrieve baseballs or softballs or wiffle balls or some level of sphere from the net to bring back to the bucket. It is a scene that Jordan and I, as two folks who ran baseball camps for much of our teen years, have seen and conducted many times, right? All right, we have 35 seconds. Pick up all the balls. Grab all the balls. And you see the kids, like, their hats are too big for their heads and their gloves are, like, clearly bent over and they're just very childish in the way that they're running. And to have that in the background of maybe the single greatest baseball thing we have ever seen. No one on the planet ever has been more talented at baseball than Shohei Ohtani. And the juxtaposition of those children running around with him getting ready to pitch for the Dodgers in the same space was so funny. And you just imagine being one of those kids like, who's that guy? Oh, yes. My God.
This is my favorite part is, and these kids maybe are a little young for this interaction, but just the idea of these kids, one of them being like, that's Shohei Ohtani.
No, it's not.
What? You idiot. No. You dummy. What are you talking about? And then they're all like, wait a minute. It's great. I love this. I love that this is the best place for him to play catch. It's great. right? I mean, there's so many parts of his life that he cannot go out into public. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll go to the local high school and toss the ball around. Also, Shohei Ohtani apparently not going to be pitching really that soon. I think Dave Roberts was like, probably May is what we would prefer. So seems like they're going to be saving those bullets for a little bit later on in the season. But I'm sure when we get more confirmation on that, we will talk about it more. My good this week is not from this week, but we haven't talked about it on the show yet. And that is Sammy Sosa is back. I contemplated putting this in bad because the fact that it took this long for the Chicago Cubs to welcome Sammy Sosa back into their organization kind of pisses me off. But Sammy Sosa put out a statement where he very vaguely acknowledged that he made mistakes, aka probably did some performance-enhancing drugs. Quote, I left it all on the field for the Cubs and the Cubs fans because I wanted to win and make the fans happy. I understand why some players in my era don't always get the recognition that our stats deserve. There were times I did whatever I could to recover from injuries in an effort to keep my strength up to perform over 162 games. I never broke any laws, but in hindsight, I made mistakes and I apologize. This was apparently what Cubs ownership was waiting for from him because now he will be at Cubs Con and he's just going to be welcome back. Oh, now remember we finally will like Sammy Sosa again. And duh, he was the coolest thing ever. Sammy Sosa was my first favorite baseball player, and I didn't live anywhere near Chicago. So I am glad that he will be back. That is a good thing. And I hope that he, you know, gets his flowers, as they say. Because, yeah, probably did steroids, and he also helped save baseball. So
very quickly, a word to the wise. Sammy Sosa looks a little bit different now than he used to. It is a very complicated, sad dynamic intertwined with the history of racism in the Dominican Republic. I am not going to dive any deeper into it right now because it's something that is sensitive and requires a lot of research. The reason I bring this up is when you see a picture of Sammy Sosa now, just read about it a little bit before you just tweet it and go LOL. That's all. It's complicated.
What is bad for you this week, Jake?
So Dave Cavill, who was the president of the Oakland A's before resigning from that position 2 weeks ago. He was the, you know, the attack dog for owner John Fisher. He was the front man. He was a lot of things, but he was instrumental in helping to move the team from Oakland to Sacramento and eventually Vegas. He is done with the A's. He no longer works for the team. That in and of itself is bad, right? Like, you created this conundrum, this colossal cluster crap, and then you just bounce. Now, you can make the argument that in his mind, like, oh, my work is done here. I got us out of Oakland. I think a lot of people in the East Bay would want to egg his house. And so what did I do, Jordan, when I heard this news? I went to Dave Cavill's LinkedIn.
What's Dave
it's
up to now?
It's already updated, okay? It's already updated. President, Oakland Athletics, November 2016 to December 2024. 8 years, 2 months. It's on there. It's closed. It's done. It's over.
So did you congratulate him on his new job?
Well, he doesn't seem to have
LinkedIn
a new
job. LinkedIn always tells me.
He doesn't have a new job, it seems. His current jobs, according to this, he is on the National Advisory Board for the Positive Coaching Alliance. Maybe he should have been helping the A's coach the last couple of years. And then the other one is he's a lecturer in management at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Lecturer, he's been doing this since 2014. Lecturer in sports management and marketing. The idea that Dave Cavill is teaching people how to manage sports teams. Tough. It's a tough look. So I went in and looked at his profile on the Stanford website. And he is currently,
I saw this too.
He is currently co-speaking or lecturing at a course that with Sam Hinkie, the former general manager of the Philadelphia 76ers, who is famous for creating the process. So that's what Dave Cavill's up to. And I think that's all vaguely bad.
Yeah. I mean, he went to Stanford and so did Sam Hinkie. So this is. That is probably relevant because I'm not so sure there would be that many other schools that would be not only having him teach, but also like have a very glowing biography of him on the website. But anyway, I think that's fair to call that bad. My bad is Louisa Rye's discourse.
Ooh, hate it.
If and when he gets traded, we can have a longer conversation about this. But all I'm going to say now is that it bums me out that people think he sucks. That's unfortunate. And also, I think unfair. He is a very specific player. I understand that. But the degree to which people are just pretending like he stinks is, I find, troubling. And I think an overcorrection as to how we evaluate baseball players, especially since he was definitely injured for most of last season and still got 200 hits. So maybe I'm old school.
Ooh.
And a total idiot that still cares about getting base hits. That's fine. He's not for everybody. That's fine. But the guy is very cool and different and special. And I would like people to appreciate that more than being like, he stinks and I don't want him on my team. It's weird. And the fact that he could get traded again does tell you something about the player type, but also I think is kind of sad and pumps.
There are so many players worse than Louisa Rice who deserve your vitriol. We've come back around on this.
Luis Ariz.
I think,
like
base hit go brr is fine. Like it's cool. It's great. He's not going to win an MVP award.
It serves a very specific purpose. Fine. Yeah, and that's fine. It's okay. I just like him. Anyway,
Ugla.
That's bad.
What's Ugla? What's weird? What's abnormal? What's different? This could also fall into bad.
Oh, okay.
The Baltimore Orioles announced their giveaways, their promotion little tchotchkes this year. And on the list for April 19th is a David Rubenstein bobblehead. David Rubenstein, of course, the new owner of the Baltimore Orioles, who took over less than a year ago. Here's why this is ugly and a little bad. It's a little early to do a little bobblehead of yourself. I saw someone quote tweet this with the Photoshop of Obama giving himself the National Medal of Honor.
I don't know if we've had a Steve Cohen bobblehead yet. What it makes me think of is the Mike Rizzo bobblehead, which I think we talked about. Yeah. Again, Nats general manager. Now, that one, the timing was funny because, again, the Nats have been very bad recently. But the guy won a World Series. Yeah. Like, he kind of has the equity. Like, it's hard. Like, he clearly has provided something. And there will always be a moment where it's like, hell yeah, Mike Rizzo. This is way too early. I understand
that
people are excited that there is a difference. But, yeah, this is too early.
O's fans and the O's world can and should be ecstatic that the Angeli are no longer running the team. Even though this offseason has been bizarre and somewhat underwhelming, they have spent money this year. He has committed more than has been committed in the past, and that is a good thing. It is not as much as people want. It is not as much as I think he will spend in future years. But to give away a caricature of the owner before winning a playoff game under his tenure feels premature to me. If the Mets want to do a Steve Cohen bobblehead right now, I think they could, because he just...
Yeah, it would be more justified. I know they haven't. They've certainly gotten a lot farther under his leadership. Yes. So it's a tough look. My Ugla this week is so funny. Reggie Jackson, one of the greatest players of all time. So we've talked about Reggie Jackson. He very strangely was working for the Houston Astros for the last 4 years. He was a special advisor and somehow got involved and was close with Jim Crane and was, like, again, part of their leadership structure in a unique way. Just a couple, he left that post. He is no longer, as of November, he is no longer working for the Astros. Okay. Whatever. That's not that big of a deal. Reggie Jackson probably has other things to do. Reggie Jackson posted on Twitter. Now, his account is not verified, but I am pretty sure that this is Reggie Jackson based on the post, based on who follows it, based on, you know, just it's clearly someone close to Reggie Jackson. Anyway, Reggie Jackson, just a few days ago, posted this. Good luck, Astros, with signing Alex Bregman. He's a very important piece. He's an Astro through and through. He's a baseball player all the way. This would be ugla. This might be more ugla if he was still working for them. Actually, it definitely would be. But posting this now, weeks after it has become very clear that Alex Bregman will not be on the Astros anymore, is so funny. And if this is somehow telling people, if he still has inside information, that somehow Alex Bregman is going to end up back on the Astros, that is also very weird and funny. But everything about this post is so strange and so hilarious. And that is my ugly this week. So what's your favorite part of the post? I think he's a baseball player all the way.
Yeah, but that's implied. Like if you ask Reggie Jackson one thing about Alex Bregman, he would be like, he's a baseball player. He's such a baseball player.
That's what true. I like, those are the good luck Astros. It's very much like I'm distancing myself. Like I'm, because he's sending good wishes. He can't, because he's not making.
You have to look at this
or part of
like
that
a
process.
Poem. If he had put a comma after Astros, good luck Astros with signing Alex Bregman, that would carry more heft to me. I love the timing of this. January 4th, he just woke up and just so posted. He was like, oh, you know what?
Right. What?
It was actually at 11:11 p.m. So maybe he saw the clock and he made a wish.
So it's 11:11 p.m. where you are in Thailand. I believe it was posted at 11:11 a.m. So unless Reggie Jackson is also in Thailand, I'm pretty sure this was posted.
So very quickly, before we do one last thing, this is me being an idiot. So related to me being in Thailand. So I was sitting on the beach yesterday on my phone and I was like, oh, I wonder, like, what are the first series of the year? Like, what is the opening day slate look like? And so I went on my phone to pull it up and I went to like Thursday, March 27th. And the only games on there were the Mets Astros and the White Sox Angels. And I got,
which is the first game, right?
I got so mad
first
because I was like, are they doing two games the night before and it's Mets, Astros, White Sox, Angels? MLB doesn't know what it's talking about at all. And then I went to the individual team schedules and I was like, these have games on the Thursday. What's going on? And it took me like 20 minutes to realize that I was in Thailand and the tough dates were just mixed up.
Tough.
So I need to come home.
Tough. You'd think you've been there for weeks. I can't believe that hasn't registered with you yet. That is our good and bad and ugly. Before we say goodbye, Jake, we did want to acknowledge another piece of news that came down a couple days ago, and it is horribly tragic and sad, and that is that former Orioles pitcher Brian Mattis passed away at the age of 37. As the time of this recording, we still do not really have details surrounding his death, but obviously anytime you see a player this young, obviously he's not been in Major League Baseball for a while, but I mean, as you know, as an Orioles fan, like, people kind of love Brian Mattis, and Brian Mattis was a, you know, it's one of those guys, right, fourth overall pick, but he became something really cool. He was a legendary college player. He was a beloved Oriole and clearly a person, a teammate that a lot of people really appreciated. And just obviously sad to see a player that I certainly hadn't thought about in a few years. And this is not how I wanted to see his name.
I have a Brian Mattis jersey that I bought when he was coming up. Like, he was part of that wave for the Orioles, the pitching prospects who didn't quite make it. But for Mattis, he became a really crucial member of their bullpen from 2013 to 2015 and was David Ortiz's kryptonite, famously, where Ortiz, I believe at one point, was 1-for-21 against Brian Mattis with like 10 strikeouts. And Mattis just had his number. A lot of tributes pouring in for Brian Mattis. Obviously, 37 is a tragic age for anyone to pass away. And our thoughts go out to his family and the people who played with him and knew him with the Orioles and the community that he was a part of at the University of San Diego around that baseball program as well.
Yeah, that and those tributes from guys like Paul Sewald, Brock Ungerich, the current head coach. He was right before Chris Bryant. Obviously, University of San Diego has become known because of the association with Bryant, but you know, Mattis was a top five pick out of USD, which is a really interesting history for that program. And he was a huge part of that. So, as you mentioned, you know, thoughts are with his family, and just wanted to acknowledge that before the end of the show. This has been quite the podcast, Jake Mintz. We have covered a lot. I have had a good time. Thank you for doing this with me. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for making this show possible. We hope everyone enjoys it. We'll be back next week. We'll do some Hall of Fame stuff. Maybe we'll get some, you know, we've had a good trickle of amount of news this week, but there are definitely still some big ones on the board that maybe we'll get resolved by the time we talk to you guys again on Monday. But hope everyone has a safe weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. And obviously, people in Los Angeles, stay safe, and we're thinking of you for sure. So thank you all for listening. You can email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon.